Omaha Public Radio presents another program from the Institute for Holocaust Education on Noon Forum. In the second of a two-part program, we'll hear the conclusion of a presentation by two Holocaust survivors, both from Hungary, Agnes Schwartz and Magda Brown, both members of the Speakers Bureau of the Illinois Holocaust Museum and Education Center. This program, co-sponsored by the Center for Faith Studies, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, March 29, 2016, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of the Institute for Holocaust Education, the Center for Faith Studies, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now is Holocaust survivor Magda Brown.
I was born and raised in Hungary, lived in a very beautiful, loving, religious family, and my childhood was the same as any of our children in this country. Happy-go-lucky. Sometimes I tell the students I would do my homework, I wouldn't do my homework. And, you know, I hung out with kids. All the fun things that a teenager should do. Matter of fact, I have a show and tell. And this is my photo of eighth grade graduation to prove it to you that I also had two eyes and two ears. And maybe the fashion was different then. But it's all just to substantiate the fact that I wasn't any different. So what happens when a happy-go-lucky child's life turns completely upside down? And how did it all happen? All of you are familiar with the onset of the rise of Hitler in 1933 in Germany. His major desire was to have a perfect race and space and slaves. And he pretty nearly accomplished his goal. So when he comes to power, he starts enacting all these desires, and he calls it the final solution, because his ultimate desire was to eliminate the Jewish race, and many, many others, as Liz had mentioned earlier, who were not Jewish, but he did not like. So what is happening in Germany, they start creating anti-Jewish laws, which was called the Nuremberg Laws. And another thing that the Nazis have done during this era, there were two units of soldiers. There was one unit of soldier who was fighting on the fields. And then there was another unit of soldiers, which was called the Einsatzgruppe. These men were trained how to finalize the final solution. They were very well trained. So how did that all play out? In 1939, the Second World War breaks out, and they start occupying many of the Eastern European countries. So let's pick a country as large as Poland. Poland had a large population as well as a large Jewish population. So the regular fighting soldiers occupy the country. But the special unit's job is to go into the Jewish home, move the people out of their home into a ghetto, from a ghetto to a concentration camp, and thus the killing machine begins. Therefore, I call the Holocaust a premeditated, scientifically coordinated mass murder. Now, I switched my thinking, my talk, into Hungary. I am living in Hungary, and as Agnes mentioned, Hungary is an ally of the Germans, so the German army stays out of Hungary for a period of time. But don't entertain the idea that our life was perfect. Certainly, a thousandfold better than our fellow Jews who were dying day after day by the thousands, because up to a point, we were still living in our own home. Up to a point, we were still going to school. Up to a point, we still had a job. But what the Hungarian government has done, they have adopted all the Nuremberg laws that was created in Germany. And now let me give you two or three of them. There were many, many, many more. So let's start with number one, the military. Until about 1940, all young men, regardless of their religious background, would enter the military service when it was time to do that. Matter of fact, My father was a dedicated soldier of the First World War, and he was a very proud Hungarian, serving his country and fighting for his country, and he would show us as children his medals, etc. So now in 1940, the government decides that the Jewish young man could no longer wear the country's uniform nor bear arms. However, he still had to enter the military compound, and they called it the Jewish Labor Force. That was their slogan, their name. So now what has happened in my family, my brother, in about 1942, he was just about military age, and my parents had to outfit him with civilian clothing, just like when we send our children to overnight camp. And my brother leaves home, enters this military compound. The Jewish boys are put in a separate unit, and they are, in a sense, already imprisoned, because where the regular soldier is allowed to go on a break or pass, you know, visit friends or whatever the reason, those boys had to have a very, very valid reason to exit the compound. And the other tragedy was that these Jewish men were treated both physically and mentally the most brutal way by the military. Next, anti-Jewish law. The professor, the journalists, pharmacists, attorneys, first they were restricted from belonging to any of their professional organizations. But then, after a little while later, they got the pink slip. So from one day to the next, they were out of a job. Now you have to think differently here a little bit. There was no such a thing as a welfare system. So the Jewish communities had to pool their resources to support thousands and thousands of unemployed people and their families. And there were many, many, many laws that was just reducing us one by one by one. And this is the reason that I tell this story so explicitly, to make you understand that genocide does not happen from one minute to the next. It builds gradually. There are many signs that will indicate that things are going the wrong way. And it is your job, especially the children of the future, to protect our freedom and watch out for all these impending signs. So these anti-Jewish laws are continuing, reducing our livelihood, reducing our freedom. It just goes down all the way till you are reduced to lower level than an animal. So, as Agnes mentioned, March 19, 1944, the Nazis enter Hungary. They walk into Hungary. They are greeted and welcomed by their fellow allies. So, like I mentioned earlier, the two units come in. Now, the Einsatzgruppe unit, the ones who are dealing with the final solution, have another plus in their favor. Adolf Eichmann is the leader of this unit. And Adolf Eichmann was the most experienced Jew killer on this earth. He had ample practice for 10 or some years to negotiate all these steps. Therefore, in Hungary, in 51 days, they are able to take you out of your home and ship you to your death. So how does that work out? When the first order is to wear the yellow star, as Agnes explained that. So that is something already painful. Next, we are the Nazis are in for this limited time, maybe 10 days. We get an order. All the Jewish people will be incarcerated into a ghetto. And to the children, I always run a comparison. What we understand in the English language, a ghetto is where ethnic people decide to reside. But thank God they have total freedom to pick up and move somewhere else. But in real life, a ghetto is something totally different. So now the government decides that in a big city, a section will be allocated to become the ghetto. And all the people in the outlying areas within the county are collected by an umbrella group of the police called the gendarmes. These are the most brutal beings. I don't even give them the courtesy of human, because I fully understand that when a soldier has to obey his orders, but when that soldier obeys his orders 200% more than what is expected of him, that's sheer brutality. And these gendarmes practice that with full strength. So, here how it plays out. The people in the outlying areas get the order that in 1 hour's time, they have to pack in a little overnight bag or a little brown bag or something, a 3-4 day supply, provision, and then they have to line up on the street to be taken to the ghetto. Now, sometimes the distance could be 2 miles, 3 miles, whatever. On foot, these gendarmes are pushing the people, shoving them, cursing at them. And by the way, there is no such a luxury as a carpool or bus ride or train ride. On foot, the babies, old people, they have to march through different locations to arrive to the ghetto area. I happen to be born in the area where that will become the ghetto. So I lived in a house that my grandfather built maybe 40 years before that. It was a very comfortable home for 6 of us, my brother and I, my parents, and an aunt and uncle who lived with us. So now this gendarme comes with the group of people into the ghetto area and looks into my house and makes an executive decision and shoves in a bunch of people. You see, human courtesy have died. Because what if in the other section of town my grandma lived, or an aunt, or a relative? They didn't care. Just a group of people. So, ladies and gentlemen, my home became the residency for 40 people. You cannot fathom what crowded condition can be. These people are exhausted. They are in shock. And now, what my parents have done, once they knew that the people will be occupying our home, days before they move the heavy pieces of furniture into the courtyard so that at least they can sit on the ground. Now comes me, the spoiled brat. Because I was the youngest child in the family, and I don't have to elaborate on it, I was spoiled. Which translates to, I had my own room and I had my own stuff. And this is where I learned to share. Because I had a closet full of clothes, etc., etc. And there were some young girls my age, and they had nothing. They had a little bag of stuff, so they could have that. So it was nice. Now, the people who came to live at my home was a tad luckier than the others in the ghetto, because my father was in the meat market business, and in Europe it was customary to smoke the meat so it does not require refrigeration at all. So we had a lot of smoked meat in our attic, so we could supplement the very meager rations that we were getting to eat. Once all the people were moved into the ghetto area, they were no longer out. It was fenced off, guarded, and we could no longer go to a doctor or a pharmacy or any of the very, very important things. We were locked in. I am going to tell you only 2 points to make you understand life in the ghetto. I call one the legal robbery and the other one the illegal robbery. Let's go with the illegal one. The Hungarian Nazi Party was largely comprised by a bunch of young, uneducated hoodlums. These people were paid off, riled up to hurt the Jew, rob the Jew, kill the Jew. And they were very obedient. So these punks would come into the ghetto. And remember, this was an established area from years back. The homes were filled with valuables. They would walk into a house. Let's say they saw a painting or a carpet or a silver tray, any of value. Pick it up and walk out with it. Now, I'm not telling you this to tell you what they rob, because they rob everything from us. To make you understand that until this time, the police protected me as well as any other citizen if a robbery would occur. This time, the police looks the other way. On to the legal robbery. We are in the ghetto for a limited time, and the order comes from the government that we have to turn over all our cash, our radios, our jewelry, and other valuables. And we were too much afraid to even think of not obeying. So here again, I am not talking about the stuff. I want you to understand that the money they took from us paid the Hungarian railroad worker to ship us to our death. We are in the ghetto for a limited time, maybe 5-6 weeks, and the order comes. The ghetto will be evacuated, and we are going to be taken to another country because they need laborers. So now we think to ourselves, okay, remember, this is already the end of May, and the war has been going on for over 5 years, so we are hoping that the war will be over, we'll go and help wherever our labor is needed, we'll be over, we'll come home, life will continue. Unfortunately, it does not play out that way. And here came the classic lie of the 20th century. The families will stay together. Now think about that. We don't have any material things anymore. We have nothing. The only thing we have is our family. So what does that mean? We don't resist. We walk like the sheep to the gallows. So now the entire ghetto is evacuated, and on foot we march to the other end of town, to a brickyard. And we start wondering, why in heaven's name did they take us to the brickyard when there's absolutely nothing except bricks? There's no furniture, there's no roof over your head, there's no toiletries, nothing. Aha. But even that was scientifically figured out, because on my 17th birthday, they put us into the boxcars. And I have a picture, which is, you can see at the Illinois Holocaust Museum, where they got the original boxcar. So, you see, they figured out the boxcars are adjacent to the railroad, the railroad track is adjacent to the brickyard, and that was a perfect location to get us out of there. So now, if you ever have a chance to see the interior of a boxcar, it's maybe from there to here, and about this wide. So you would figure maybe 30, 35 people could sit on the ground, okay. Ah, but that didn't work out that way. They shoved in as many as 80 to 85 people. There was literally standing room only. You would just shift one way or the other way. In order to allow my parents to sit on the wooden floor, I stood shifting 1 inch this way or that way for 3 solid days. Once they slammed the door on us, in the corner were 2 buckets, one for toilet use, and one bucket was filled with water, except that water was never, ever refilled. So, ladies and gentlemen, besides emotional stress and physical pain, the absolute worst thing is thirst. Nobody on this earth should experience what thirst really is, because they never refill those water container. And what happens after a while, you are so thirsty, you forget about your physical pain. You forget about where you are. The only thing you can concentrate on, if I could only have a slip of water. Your mouth is dry. Your lips are parched. And there are many issues within the boxcar. There are every personality present there. There is the quiet one. There is the one who is cursing. The one who is praying. There is everything. Crying. Any emotions that you have studied in Psychology 101, it was there. And the only one other thing I want to mention about the boxcar is that in the corner was a young woman with a baby on her bosom, but unfortunately, that, or maybe fortunately, the baby died on her bosom rather than suffering another way of dying. So now we have no idea where we're going. On the third day, the train stops, open the doors, and some strange-looking men in striped uniform come aboard, and we don't even understand what language they're speaking, but somehow or another, your senses understand the sign language. What they were trying to say, the little bit of belongings you brought from home, leave it in the boxcar, you'll get it later. Later never comes. It's collected by a different crew of people once we are emptied out of the train, and that unit sorts out the stuff, and if they find some valuables in there, it goes to the fatherland, etc. So now we exited the train. The men are directed to go in that direction, and that's the last time I see my dear father and any of the male relatives who came with us. Now we have a sea of people on this ramp. But you see, you have to do your mathematics. It would not be feasible to send one train of people on a long journey. So depending on the size of the individual community, they couple together as maybe as 50 or 55 of these train loads. So when we arrive, there are several thousand people. Matter of fact, post-war statistics indicate that Hungary exited 147 of these train transports in 51 days, equaling close to 500,000 people. So now we are marching forward, and all of a sudden, a group of Nazi officers are facing us, and they do like this, which translates to stop. You see, we are no longer people. We don't have a name. We just like the zombies, do this, move this way, the ordering around continuously. So now one Nazi officer steps forward, points a finger at you. So you go this way. And my beautiful young-looking mother, who was holding on to me, is directed that away. And I'll get back to that away later. Matter of fact, As I'm moving, I tell her, I see you later, mother. Unfortunately, later never comes. So now comes a succession of expediency. Next room, a giant room, disrobe completely. Lay down your clothes on the floor, and then you'll get a shower, you'll get the last stitch of clothes from home later. Forget it. Nothing. Now we are stark naked into another room. Now remember, I'm 17 years old. What is the most important thing for a young girl at age 17? To fix her hair. And now in this room, they are shaving our hair bald, and all our body hair are shaven. And if that's not bad enough, they spray disinfectants on our freshly shaven skin. The girls were screaming so loud that it could shake the building because of the shock and the total picture. It was a horrible experience. From here, we went into another room, which was called the shower. Well, don't entertain the idea that the shower came anywhere close to where you took a shower at home. This was nothing more than an empty room with about 50 shower heads screwed into the ceiling, and literally a trickle of water was reaching your dirty, smelly body. No soap, no towel, no clean underwear. Next room. Now we go into this room that has a mountain of clothing. I mean, to the ceiling. A person behind it don't even look at you, just throws a garment at you. They don't look at you. Are you short, tall, fat, skinny, whatever? Zero. I ended up with a long slip. And for shoes, they took that away too. They gave us flip-flops that has wooden sole. It's the most horrible thing to walk in because it has a leather band across it and it rubs against your foot and it's bad. So now it's time to go to sleep. They put us into a totally empty room, because if you have seen Auschwitz photographs, you can see the prisoners like sitting on a bunk bed idea. But this was a totally empty room because the Hungarian Jews were taken to Auschwitz number 2 called Birkenau. And Birkenau was the location where they had the crematoriums. So about 2 years prior to our arrival, they leveled off about 5 or 6 Polish villages surrounding the area. So when the next transports come, they built additional railroad tracks from the arrival spot of Auschwitz proper directly into the Birkenau crematorium section. So when we were separated, the people would shove back in the train and they would ship right direct to the area where the crematorium was. So now we are in the, so that's why Birkenau was nothing more than a transitory camp for us to be killed. So that's why they didn't bother with any bunk beds or nothing. Now, the room would have held maybe 200 people lying down on the floor. But we got to be a unit of 500. So in order for us to lay on the flat floor, 500, they laid us down like the sardines in the can. So then the amount would fill. And to this day, I can't figure out something. We were not permitted to go outdoors during the night to use the latrines, which is the toilet, but it was a latrine. A latrine is nothing more than a giant hole that was dug in the ground, a wooden plank across it, some circles to sit down. And during the night, they didn't allow us to go out for that service, but they put 2 buckets in our corner of the room, and you can imagine 500 people, it was not a happy sight. So now, we're sleeping, a crack of dawn, 4 o'clock in the morning, we are awakened, out. As we were in the crumpled clothes, there's no such a thing as brush your teeth or wash your face or any of the normalcies of life, out we go, and now we are the unit of 500, and they have an older prisoner who is designated to be our so-called supervisor. And her job is to get us out into the courtyard, and there comes another painful situation. It is called the counting. You had to stand 5 abreast, and this supervisor would count you 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. This counting insanity could take 1 hour, 2 hours, 2 times a day, 3 times a day. Why? Where in heaven's name could he have gone to? Number one, every couple of yards we had a woman, Nazi woman guard with a police dog. Every couple of yards there were watchtowers with a machine gun, a soldier aiming a machine gun at us. And if that's not enough, the entire camp was surrounded by electrified barbed wire fence. But they kept counting us. Food, I don't even want to bring that up because it was a green, horrible smelling liquid with some stuff floating in it, unrecognizable. Matter of fact, the first day when we got there, we were gagging on it, and some of the old timers gathered around us and said, give it to us. And we did, but little did we realize that we better don't do that again because that's the only food we're going to have to sustain us. If our total calorie a day was perhaps 400 calories, maybe 500. So, these were the days, and there's one more thing I want to mention about Auschwitz, and that is when we were there for about a couple of days, the old timers were, we were asking the old timers, could you tell us how soon we're going to see our relatives who went that away? Inevitably, they raised their arm, they pointed to the 5 chimneys. See, we kept seeing the chimneys spewing out very heavy black smoke, and it had a burning smell that was like when you kill a chicken and you have put it over a fire to burn off the feather. It was that smell, but we could not who had time to analyze what that is? And they said, that's where your parents are. We absolutely refused to believe what they were saying. Unfortunately, later we realized the reality of it. So all our poor darlings who were taken there away, they used so much trickery, it's unbelievable. The way they made them comfortable, even they had an undressing room with a hook on the wall and had numbers on it. And they would tell them, get undressed here and remember the number where you hung your clothes so you can find it afterwards. Unfortunately, it doesn't turn out that way. So that's why whenever a denier comes up from the woodworks that the crematorium was an imagination, it was unfortunately very, very true. So this was the very limited overview of Auschwitz life. Then came the other situation that called the selection. The selection meant that, let's say my unit of 500 were ordered to go out into the courtyard and disrobe halfway. And I guarantee you, they were not looking for our sexual beauty. They were looking how strong your upper arm was, and they were selecting the stronger person to be shipped out of the country. So 1,000 of us Hungarian women were selected to be shipped out of Auschwitz. Therefore, I do not have a tattoo, because they were anxious, number one, to kill us first in Birkenau. Second, they were anxious to get it out of Auschwitz. So now the 1,000 of us were put on the train, and we ended up in Stadt Allendorf, which is the vicinity of Marburg, Kassel, Frankfurt area in Germany. And our job was to work in an ammunition factory that manufactured rockets and bombs. So now most of us 1,000 girls were teenagers or just out of school or young women. We have never seen a factory, let alone work in a factory. But you'd be surprised when they force you to do things, how fast you learn the most menial work on earth. So what was our job? First of all, we had to march to the factory. And here I tell you something that I bet you have never heard in any of your Holocaust books or anything about the subject. What has happened when we marched to the camp, to the factory, I'm sorry, we marched underground because the factory was built with a flat roof, sodded, trees growing out of it, and when the Allied reconnaissance trains were searching the area, they saw nothing more than a nice meadow. But we were right there. So now our job was to fill the bombs with highly poisonous liquid material. And we did it. It was in front of your workbench. There were pipes coming through, and we would fill these bombs and lock it. And then two people had to lift it to carry it to a warehouse location. And we were doing this 12 hours a day, 1 week during the day, 1 week at night. It was a bad routine. Hard work. And we were housed in an old deserted army barrack. So our living conditions were a tad better than in Auschwitz, because now we had a bunk bed, we had some straw to sleep on, and they gave us an itchy horse blanket. So anyhow, one time I am sitting on the edge of the bed, and we were 16 of us in one room. And I started crying, and I'm not a crying personality. And my roommates asked me, why are you crying? What's the matter with you? I said, I am so hungry that I can't see straight. I want you to know that, you know, we always saved a little bit of bread in case we don't get any breakfast. So we saved something from the supper bits of bread. They grabbed their little crust of bread and they shared it with me. And that is the true sharing of caring for one another. So, after a couple of months, we are working at this factory. Now our hair starts growing out into crew cut size, And we look at each other, and we don't quite look the way we looked before. Some of our hairs turned orange, our face lemon yellow, and our lips became deep, dark purple. What has taken place? We were working with this highly poisonous material without any protective garments, and it started invading our body. But thank God, the end was nearing. At the end of March, the director of the camp received an order from headquarters to put us on a death march towards Buchenwald, because that was the closest campsite. And in a very thin spring coat, on a wet, cold march, they put us on the highway. That's why I never want to be cold ever again either, because that was bad. And now on foot, we marched, and we had to protect our sick ones because the punishment would have been too great. During the night, we slept in the ditches on the wet ground. And on the third day, we arrived to a farm area. And we have noticed that there aren't as many Nazi guards with us as when we started at the campsite. I guess they were trying to save their own lives, whatever. So now we are standing in front of this farm, a group of us about 12 or whatever, and you see we lived in faith and fantasy. So here it comes, the fantasy. How would it be if during the night, one by one, we crawl and we reach that barn that was like maybe two blocks yonder, and we'll hide there? You see, the important thing here is we have totally lost our self-esteem. So what? They find us, they shoot us, it will be all over. But, thank God, the next day, two young men are walking towards us to this barn, and they wore a different uniform we were not familiar with, but it turned out to be two scouts from the 6th Armored Division of the U.S. Army, God bless them all, and they were our liberators. Thank you. Thank you very much. I forgot one more thing. Wait, one more thing that I tell mostly for the young people in the audience. My closing remarks are to you, because you are our future. Protect your freedom in every possible way you can, because slavery is terrible. Second, I want you to think very hard before you hate. I am not telling you to hate or not to hate. That is up to your conscience, but at least give it some thought. Thirdly, there are constantly people denying the existence of the Holocaust. So if anyone doubts what Agnes and I have and other survivors have been telling, our famous General Eisenhower was one of the liberators with his unit of soldiers in an Ohrdruf camp, which was a pretty bad concentration camp. He was shocked, and he summoned his soldiers and told them, take as many photographs as you can, because the world will not believe it. So I'm reading you his quotation that will further understand how he felt. And here it goes. I have never felt able to describe my emotional reaction when I first came face to face with indisputable evidence of Nazi brutality and ruthless disregard of every shred of decency. I visited every nook and cranny of the camp because I felt it my duty to be in a position from then on to testify at first hand about these things in case there ever grew up at home the belief or assumption that the stories of Nazi brutality were just propaganda. So keep that in mind. And now, if anyone has any questions, let's hope we can give you an answer.
Two questions. What mechanism did you use to survive, and what mechanisms did you use to forgive?
Okay.
You don't forget.
I have long forgiven the perpetrators because I want to live in peace. So therefore, how can I promote to these children what I just said a minute ago, don't hate, if I continue hating? Now remember, when I was first liberated, I could not have made that remark to you because the pain was so acute. Now you asked me the other part of how did I keep going? Faith, courage, determination, and lots and lots of helpers. I thank every volunteer around the world because there are so many incidents in my life that came through the help of volunteers. And faith in God. I mean, there's no other way of doing it because I've been up and down even in my life afterwards where somehow I'm still here. Yes.
Just curious. I know you were surviving and all, but I was always kind of curious about like your high holidays. Did you ever have that inside your heart, you know, during the high holidays?
Yes. Or? And I'll tell you how that was. In the camp, we were, as I told you earlier, we were watched constantly. But somehow, remarkable how a human brain can come up with ways of hiding. The only hiding place we had was behind the latrines. They did not watch over us every second. So among us, there were many very, very religious women. And they were older than the every 17-year-old. And I don't know how, but they knew about religion. They knew, not religion, but they knew about holidays. And they would gather us youngsters, and they would say the prayers with us. And they kept our faith going. But, I mean, it was an unbelievable experience.
Question here. My question is, what happened to Julia?
Julia.
Okay, it's your turn.
Okay. Julia and I, well, first of all, my relationship with my father fell apart because I felt deserted by him. And he would write me, and I would write him less and less often. But Julia and I corresponded, and then my father told me that she passed away. Now, in my memory, Julia appears to have been older than my parents. And by this time, I was grown, and I contacted Yad Vashem in Israel. And by this time, I truly appreciated how she risked her life to save mine because at age 11, I'm not sure if I was truly appreciative enough of that. And I wanted to plant a tree for her in the Avenue of the Righteous Christians, and they wanted proof, and there was no proof. So finally, after 2 years, they accepted her, and then they wanted to send her family documentation. She had no family. And perhaps that helped her give the courage to save my life because as a child asked me not long ago, if the shoe was on the other foot, would you have saved someone? And it takes a lot of thinking. You want to say right away, of course I would have. But if I had a family whose life I would have jeopardized, would I have? Could I have? I don't have an answer to that. So Julia, since she was alone, I think that was one of the things that she gave her courage to save my life. And I was at Yad Vashem about 5 years ago, and then the emotions of the whole thing really got to me, and I finally felt I was at her graveside, and I truly thanked her properly at that time.
What perspectives or lessons should be learned from your experiences and what happened with what's going on today in terms of people being killed in Africa and the Middle East? And
it's very, very scary. There is no excuse for genocide, and that's the only way to put it, for people to kill each other just because there's a difference of religion or a different, somebody looks different, that is preposterous. There are good and bad in every kind, and I usually tell the children, get to know people before you decide whether you like them or you don't like them. And then if you don't like them, then you walk away. And we live in a very scary world today, and anti-Semitism in Europe is very much on the rise again. And I am very grateful that my children all grew up in the United States. And this may not be the perfect place, but it sure is the best place in the world.
Thank you. Agnes, your story is my mother's story, but my mother grew up in occupied Norway as an 11-year-old Lutheran girl.
Mm-hmm.
And she describes to me an encounter that she had in a cafe waiting for a boat to go home of encountering an SS officer. And to this day, she says that is the most terrified she's ever been in her entire life. Sometimes I struggle to try to understand that. But when you guys saw them, could you see any humanity in them? Because my mother couldn't.
No, I can't see any humanity in any of it. All I can see is hate and pre-planned murder. And they worked for years to plan the annihilation of the European Jews, and they almost succeeded. They almost succeeded. Budapest Jews, they killed half of them, and the outlying areas, a much larger percentage. Those who went to the camps, most of them didn't come.
I have a different opinion. I mean, yes, brutality I described to you quite clearly, but there's humanity still comes forth and kindness. And let me tell you how that was. I was working in the factory, and we had old men, civilians, as supervisors, because, you know, everybody was at war. And this little old man must have been about 70 years old, and when you are 17, a 70-year-old is very old. So, I spoke at that time fluent German. So I could talk with him. Do you know that he brought me several times a green apple? If you eat the best chocolate on earth, caviar, anything that is beyond normal to your palate, could not compare with that green apple, because we haven't seen fruit or vegetables or anything for some time. So may have not been many, okay, but at least there was one. So I give him the honor to remember him.
Of course, Julia had the humanity. She hid me. She risked her life to save mine.
So, yeah.
So, you know, there were just too few. Or some were just too scared.
Did you have any after effects from the chemicals that your body absorbed when you worked in the chemical?
Fortunately factory? Not. And I'll tell you why. We were nearing the end, and as such, after we were liberated, our first thing to do was to eat. Incessantly eat. A thick slice of bread, just a thick layer of butter on it, then honey over it. I won't tell you the abdominal effects, but it was an absolute necessity. So to answer your question, we had proper nourishment after the liberation. And we were young, and God's help. I mean, I really, medically, I could not explain any other reasons, but we are here. Now, there was one lady who died in our camp, and she's buried there. Matter of fact, when we went to Germany to visit the camp in 1990, we visited her graveside. And we really don't know of the origin of her death, but it can be very likely the possibility that she was affected by that problem.
By the poison? By the poison?
I'm guessing. Now, yeah. But it's a possibility. That's the only one that died from our group. Yes.
One final question. You advised us to think very hard before we hate. But then you also said that it has to be on our conscience to decide whether we hate or not. And then you made the statement that you had to forgive because you couldn't live. That's how you decided to keep living. How do you live in both of those states at the same time?
You have to make a conscious decision which way to go. I'm going to give you a very brief comment of my personal experience. I spoke at the gathering, and afterwards, a young man approached me, and a non-Jewish young man, and he was asking me many questions, and very briefly he said, both my grandfathers were Nazi officers. Matter of fact, they served, and he told me, camps and what have you. And he said, now they are in purgatory. And I don't know where he's going. Right. So here it comes. He said, it was a church gathering, and it was, you know, church meeting to follow my presentation. So he said, when I go back to the church, and I look into the picture of Jesus Christ, I would very much like to see your face of forgiveness in that picture. It's not a simple little question to answer. But God is in my corner all the time because he comes to my rescue. And I answered him. In the Jewish religion, our holiest of holidays, the Day of Atonement. We fast, we pray, and among our prayers, we ask God for forgiveness to forgive our sins. And among them, there is another little prayer that says, forgive the sins of your perpetrators. If you have ever seen a relief on a child's face, it was worth the entire presentation where I, you know, just to see that. So, and I told him, I said, I could not have told you this right after the tragedy. But as years pass, so that was my answer. So
your faith is the thing that helps you to hate and forgive at the same time.
Exactly.
Thank you.
Okay, may I answer that question too? Because my perspective is very different than Magda's. I have not forgiven them, and I don't think I ever will. Now, we've had some young people from Germany come and work at the Illinois Holocaust Museum, and I'm part of them. Both of us are part of their speakers bureau. And those kids have impressed me so much. They're trying to dedicate a year of their life to serve the Jewish community, and in essence, they're atoning for the sins of their elders. And some of them were quite open about knowing that their grandparents were Nazis, and they can't understand how. And I've truly taken these young people to my heart because they're not the Nazi era people. But for many years, I had a very difficult time separating. I mean, to me, all Germans were Nazis. And it's not true. Today's generation are not Nazis, and they're wonderful young people. But those who killed my family, no, I will never forgive.
But there is one other project that's going on that I'm just throwing it out. You can Google it. It's called Germany:Close Up. And this is between Jewish organizations and German groups, and they have exchanged among young people. Matter of fact, two of my little friends, they are in their 20s, visited this program in Berlin last spring. And the German young adults, greet these people. They take them to Holocaust sites. They take them to important places. So they're interacting like people should. So there's a hope for future along these lines.
Isn't that interesting that today Russians are immigrating to Germany. Russian Jews are immigrating to Germany to feel safe. So the world has kind of come in a circle.
Okay.
Were they not wonderful? Please.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Very much. Please thank you very take much. A moment to take in the love here in this country.
Thank you for giving us the opportunity.
You've been listening to a program from the Institute for Holocaust Education on Noon Forum. We've heard the conclusion of a talk by two Holocaust survivors, both from Hungary, Agnes Schwartz and Magda Braun, both members of the Speakers Bureau of the Illinois Holocaust Museum and Education Center. This program, co-sponsored by the Center for Faith Studies, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, March 29, 2016, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Liz Feldstern, Executive Director of the Institute for Holocaust Education, and Kelly Keller, Director of the Center for Faith Studies, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 600 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.